This is KGNU's Morning Magazine. It's Tuesday, December 14th, 2021. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up on today's program, we'll hear about a photography exhibit opening tonight, which documents the recovery process from March's mass shooting at King Soopers. Zapping the ocean with electricity to fight climate change? That story and more in H2O Radio's This Week in Water. And we'll play our weekly comment line. At the bottom of the hour, we'll go to the BBC News headlines. Then it's How on Earth? On this week's KGNU Science Show, we hear about the epidemic of fentanyl abuse and fatal overdoses in Colorado. At 9 a.m., it's the wit and wisdom of Alan Watts, the British philosopher, writer, and speaker known for interpreting Eastern religious ideas for a Western audience. Then at 9:30, Neil Smart will be in the Boulder studio for the Morning Sound Alternative to bring you 2.5 hours of eclectic music until noon. But first, it's time for local and regional headlines with KGNU's Stacey Johnson.
The state of Colorado reached $1 million settlement on Monday over a 2015 mine spill near Silverton. Rocky Mountain Community Radio's Lucas Brady Woods has more.
The $1.6 million settlement with Sunnyside Gold Corporation finds the company responsible for the damage caused by wastewater that spilled from the Gold King mine back in 2015. During the spill, acidic wastewater from the mine damaged natural resources in the surrounding Bonita Peak Mining District Superfund site, which sits just north of Silverton. It also spilled into the Animas River and turned the river water orange. From there, the mine waste made its way into the San Juan River, which travels through New Mexico, the Navajo Nation, and eventually merges with the Colorado River. According to Colorado Attorney General Phil Weiser's office, this week's settlement finds that Sunnyside Gold Corporation's decision to plug a different mine resulted in the spill. Blocking that mine caused contaminated waste to build up inside the nearby Gold King mine and eventually spill out. The Attorney General's office says the settlement money will be used to restore the surrounding damage, as well as damage caused by other releases of hazardous materials. The agreement was approved by the Colorado Natural Resources Trustees, which includes the head of the state's Department of Natural Resources, the head of the Department of Public Health and Environment, and the Attorney General. Now the settlement agreement will go through a 30-day public comment period before the courts decide whether to approve it. For Rocky Mountain Community Radio, I'm Lucas Brady Woods in Southwest Colorado.
A Jefferson County District Court judge has sentenced a truck driver to 110 years in prison after he was found guilty of killing 4 people in a fiery crash on I-70. The judge issued the sentence yesterday after he determined that it was the mandatory minimum sentence set forth under state law, requiring consecutive sentences without judicial discretion. A jury in October found the driver guilty of 4 counts of vehicular homicide, among other counts of assault, careless and reckless driving, stemming from an April 2019 crash on Interstate 70 in Lakewood. The driver, who was 23 at the time of the crash, lost his brakes in the high country and failed to take a runaway trunk ramp before his speeding semi-trailer rammed into stop traffic. The crash caused a fiery 28-car pileup that killed 4 people and wounded 6 others. Denver's legislation banning most flavored tobacco products is no longer in existence as the city council failed to meet a 9-vote threshold to overturn a veto by Mayor Michael Hancock. The city council voted again last evening in favor of the ban with a vote of 8-4 with 1 member absent. The city council initially passed the ban last week with the mayor issuing his veto on Friday. The ban was first introduced in October to curb youth tobacco use, particularly with vaping, and was to apply to flavored tobacco products in all establishments in Denver, with the exceptions for hookah, natural cigars, pipe tobacco, and harm reduction tools. Hancock said the ban would have a negative impact on local businesses and would not be effective in preventing youth tobacco use as users continue to buy products in neighboring jurisdictions. Well, county commissioners have agreed to no longer publish information about COVID-19 on the county's social media platforms and beyond. KGN News, Steve Miller has more.
Since Weld County is a home rule charter county, it means it does not have an independent board of public health. If commissioners say they will no longer publish information about COVID-19 on the county's social media platforms, then the county health department can't publish information either. At a board meeting on November 24th, three members of the public admonished the commissioners for Facebook posts on the Weld County website regarding vaccines. One Facebook post entered on November 9th that created the anger of some of the public had a timeline for those who wanted to be fully vaccinated in time for the holidays. According to the public, this made it sound like they were being pressured into getting the vaccine. The Weld County Commissioner said the reasoning behind the posting was that the county had paid a consultant to conduct a study into vaccine rates in Weld County because they wanted to find ways to increase the vaccine rates. I'm Steve Miller for KGNU.
The American Red Cross of Colorado and Wyoming is deploying 5 disaster responders to Kentucky as part of relief efforts to help those affected by last week's devastating tornadoes. According to a press release from the American Red Cross, the relief organization is moving as quickly as it can to get additional volunteers, supplies, and help to the hardest hit areas. The Boulder City Council will hold a public hearing this evening for an emergency measure that will put into place new oil and gas regulations before the city's current moratorium is set to expire on December 31st. Colorado Oil and Gas Commission, under the 2019 passage of Senate Bill 181, now grants local governments the authority to impose limits on oil and gas activity within their borders. Among the proposed regulations, oil and gas operators will be required to provide a series of applications and an alternative site analysis, along with holding neighborhood meetings in impacted areas. Oil and gas sites will also need to be 2,000 feet from any residential dwelling, school, or licensed childcare facility, or a 2,500-foot setback for multi-well pads. According to a city memo reviewed by the Daily Camera, very few properties in the city limits will be eligible for oil and gas operations based on the 2,000-foot setback. The city council will begin tonight's meeting at 6 p.m. Today's weather along the upper metro Front Range includes mostly cloudy skies with highs reaching near 60. Tonight will be partly cloudy with a low of 30 for Fort Collins and the upper 30s for Denver and Boulder. Tomorrow there is a high wind warning in effect starting at 8 a.m. The current temperature outside the Boulder studios is 35 degrees. For KGNU, I'm Stacy Johnson.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU, an exhibit of photographs documenting the aftermath of the King Soopers mass shooting last March opens tonight at Chautauqua's Community House. Ross Taylor created the series, which is in partnership with the Museum of Boulder. KGNU's Alexis Kenyon spoke with him about the exhibit.
So all of these photos are centered around the King Soopers shooting and the aftermath. Tell me about the exhibit. What should people expect to see?
Well, thanks again. I appreciate the chance to talk about it. It's a series of portraits of people who have had some intersection with the events of the previous year. So we have photographed over 25 people and we just started. But this first section is primarily people in the community. And that also includes King Super employees and people from mental health partners who work with aspects of healing and assistance at the Boulder Strong Resource Center. And we wanted to get a good sense of the environment before beginning. So the portrait project began early to mid fall, and it's of people where they are now.
How did you come to this idea of doing a photo essay about this? I mean, is this something that you had photos for and then decided to put together?
Sure. So when the events happened this year, I photographed that following week along the fence primarily, and some of the memorial events, but I felt like there was more to be done. And over the summer, I thought that perhaps trying to work on a large scale portrait project, large scale in the sense of numbers, if we could try to build an archive. And so I approached the Museum of Boulder with this idea. And thankfully, right away, they got on board. I feel like they gave the project a lot of validity and a lot of reason for me to reach out to people. And I'm very grateful for the Museum of Boulder to allow that partnership to exist.
You describe your portraits as collaborative. Can you tell me about what that means?
Yeah. So before moving into academia, I was a photojournalist, and it was more or oftentimes seen as we would photograph and then we would decide what was published. But here, I feel like this is more of an archive, and I'm trying to build a collaborative archive of Boulder. And I want people to have some agency in how they're represented. So I'm consistently showing them the work as I photograph them. And a lot of times we just get feedback along the way. And I want them to be able to tell me how they want to be photographed. And I think given the profoundly delicate nature of what we're trying to do, I have to keep in mind when we begin to think about asking people to revisit aspects of the moment in time in their lives or moments in time in their lives that are very difficult. I think it's even more important to ask their involvement and their agency.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting thing to think about, because I think a lot of times journalism is this kind of removed lens. Have you noticed a change in your photos, or what kinds of photos does that create?
I think it's a great question. I think it's a different experience in the sense of, as a journalist, I'm reminded that oftentimes a journalist's role is to attempt to record visions of and aspects of the truth as it happens. So I find it, frankly, in many ways more intimate, may not be the right word, but I feel more connected to those that I'm photographing. And I feel tied to the project and to their experience in ways that I wouldn't as a photojournalist. It's nice.
What did you learn from taking these photos and creating this series?
I think I've learned and have been reminded of the profound level of loss that comes with the mass shooting. I think we forget in this, we remember it the first week, the first 2 weeks, we were reminded it through reports of the news and our own interaction, but it is easy to forget that even a year later that event has had a rippling. And I think if I can add a space and an opportunity and a time where people can come together and see themselves and see others in the community who have gone through similar experiences, it is my hope that people can feel heard and can feel seen. And I think that promotes some of the healing process.
Is there anything else that I should ask you or that you'd like to add?
I'm just grateful for the opportunity to talk about the project. And I'm really passionate about this, and it's growing fast. And I can see this continue to grow. So if anybody who has had an intersection or been impacted and would like me to make a portrait of them, they could certainly contact me.
Ross Taylor is an assistant professor of photography at CU Boulder. His exhibit, A Lens Towards Healing, opens tonight at Chautauqua's Community House. Ross, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
How durable are constitutions? How amendable is the U.S. Constitution? To answer these questions, we'll hear Jill Lepore, American history professor and affiliate law professor at Harvard College, where she conducts the Amendment Project. Tune in to hear Jill Lepore Tuesday at 6, right here on Hemispheres.
The Environmental Protection Agency has ruled the White Mesa uranium mill in southeastern Utah can no longer accept radioactive waste from Superfund sites. KZMU's Justin Higginbottom speaks with a lawyer who fought for this decision about the mill's future.
Ute Mountain Ute Tribe activists have long claimed the country's last uranium mill, operating just a few miles from their land, does not meet environmental standards. In a decision last week, the EPA agreed. The agency called the mill's violation of the Clean Air Act regarding waste taken from Superfund sites egregious.
The CERCLA offsite rule, it is meant to make sure that when EPA is cleaning up Superfund sites, that they don't create a new Superfund site by cleaning up another one. So you don't want to move your hazardous materials from one location to another and then create another hazardous situation.
That's Scott Clow, the tribe's environmental program manager. The issue is with Cell 4B, a reservoir where the mill stores waste.
We sent a picture to the EPA in August when we had a flyover there as part of the article that was done in High Country News. And the photo on the cover of High Country News shows the issue. We did reach out to the EPA because we've had concerns about their compliance with the law.
From the sky, the cell looks like a huge square pond, less than half of it filled with water. The empty part looks coated with a white material. It's that section that worries Clow. He says the mill should have a layer of water covering the entire cell to protect against radon emissions. The EPA's decision could impact the mill's business. It currently receives Superfund material from the Spokane Reservation in Washington.
This is a big part of their business now. You know, they don't have many, if any, mines in operation. They don't mill a lot of conventional ore from their mines. They make a lot of money receiving other byproduct materials, run them through the mill, and then dispose of them there forever. They're trying to sustain their business. We understand that, but we certainly are not excited about the transition in that business to being essentially a more of a disposal facility than a mill.
Future business with the Navajo Nation, which is busy cleaning up uranium tailings on their land, could also be impacted, according to Clow.
They really want the Navajo materials to go to the mill and to be paid handsomely through Superfund for that purpose. Obviously, with a non-suitability determination, that could very likely change that. We have met with the work group that is trying to determine the fate of those materials from the Navajo cleanup, and we made them aware of our concerns. This could conceivably remove the mill from their short list of places for those materials to go.
Energy Fuels provided a statement saying they were extremely surprised by the letter and called it all a big misunderstanding. The company notes in 2019, the EPA found nothing wrong with the cell in question. The agency hasn't visited the mill since that decision, and Energy Fuels claim the crystalline material in the pond emits radon at levels 5 times below the legal limits. The EPA, meanwhile, questions whether that material is only crystalline. Here's Clow again.
I can tell you that the EPA under Andrew Wheeler is much different than the EPA under Michael Regan. And we appreciate what Mr. Regan and the new regional administrator and the career staff at EPA who have hung in there for the last 4 years have done.
Energy Fuels can appeal the decision, and processing Superfund waste is only one part of their business. Recently, the mill has looked to enter the rare earths element market, producing material used for things like electric car batteries. Justin Higginbottom for KZMU News.
Time now for This Week in Water with H2O Radio's Jamie Sudler and Franny Halperin.
Zapping the ocean with electricity to fight climate change? That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Starting in January, all residents of California will be required to make New Year's resolutions to recycle their food waste instead of tossing it in the trash.
Waste that usually ends up in landfills like banana peels, coffee grounds, and eggshells breaks down and emits methane, a greenhouse gas that's more powerful in the short term than carbon emissions from burning fossil fuels.
Now people will have to put their food waste into green bins to be collected by cities and turned into compost or used to make biogas for heating and electricity. Recycling food waste is the easiest and fastest way for individuals to affect climate change, according to Rachel Wagner, director of California's recycling program.
As an alternative to the green bins, residents will be able to compost in their yards or take food to drop-off locations. Grocery stores will have to donate edible food to food banks.
The new program is aimed mainly at education instead of enforcement, but municipalities will either need to have food waste recycling programs in place by March or tell the state how they will implement one.
According to the Los Angeles Times, the biggest challenge will be to build up to 150 compost digesting centers to break down all the organic material.
A new report is urging the U.S. government to spend over $1 billion to research the possibility of increasing the ocean's capacity to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. Oceans have already absorbed about 30% of the CO2 released by human activities, and the report by the Panel of National Academies of Sciences outlines 6 geoengineering approaches to boost that amount and study potential consequences.
Some of the methods to be studied include jolting the seas with electricity to make them less acidic, adding nutrients like nitrogen to help plankton take up carbon, farming seaweed to transport carbon to ocean sediments, and helping ecosystems become healthier so animals and plants could absorb more CO2.
The report says there could be devastating consequences to such large-scale interventions like disrupting fisheries or changing weather patterns and ocean currents, but they say because private groups are already doing research, the government needs to be prepared to make policies.
Geoengineering is controversial. Pennsylvania State University climatologist Michael Mann writes, it's being used by polluters to delay and downplay the only safe solution to climate change, rapidly curtailing fossil fuels.
Manatees, marine mammals, also known as sea cows, are in trouble. More than 1,000 have died off the Florida coast from starvation this year, prompting officials to take drastic action to feed them, to get them through the winter.
Manatees' primary diet is seagrass, but pollution from fertilizers, urban runoff, and wastewater discharges is causing algal blooms that choke out the sunlight the grasses need to grow. Climate change is expected to worsen the problem with warming waters and severe storms.
Officials announced a trial feeding program at a handful of sites, including a power plant in Cape Canaveral, where manatees congregate in winter because of warm water discharged from the facility. The animals would be offered leafy greens like lettuce and cabbage, which they are fed in captivity.
As the Palm Beach Post reports, the plan is not without risk. Biologists are concerned about changing manatee migration patterns and encouraging the animals to depend on humans.
Officials warn that the intervention is being run by experts and that feeding manatees is illegal. They expect the rescue response will be needed for at least several years until seagrass habitats are restored.
And finally, the fashion industry has been called out for lacking sustainability. Dye used to color fabric contaminates waterways, and manufacturing textiles generates 10% of annual global carbon emissions.
Making clothes is water-intensive, using enough to meet the annual needs of 5 million people, and plastic microfibers from textiles are piling up in our oceans.
Amsterdam designer Jofia Kolar thinks there's an eco-friendly solution right under our noses, or rather, right above them. She is making clothes from human hair.
She collects cut hair from local salons that would otherwise go to landfills. Through her company Human Material Loop, she has used some blonde locks to create her first prototype knitted sweater.
Hair that can't be woven into yarn is repurposed as fertilizer in a closed-loop system where there's zero waste from the production.
Recycling human hair is not new. In recent years, salons have collected it to be used as so-called hair booms to clean up oil spills or, because it's rich in protein and nitrogen, for use as compost.
So would you wear clothes made from human hair? Kolar says it's normal for us to don fabrics from animal hair like sheep or alpaca, so why not our own? Your next trip to a stylist could be to get a cool do and do something cool for the environment.
That's it for this week in water. We're sustainable because of support from our listeners. Become one of them by visiting h2oradio.org, and thank you.
We now check in with KGNU's comment line and the listeners who share their thoughts on what they hear on KGNU.
Hi. I was listening to Hemispheres on November 30th. And Jim Nelson, the host, made some reference to something he had heard on the BBC. Rob Prince had this to say about that. Don't confuse the articulation of the BBC commentators with what actually goes on in the Middle East area. Now, I don't know exactly what he was implying, but I'd like to hear more about this. I suggest that KGNU host a debate about the veracity of the BBC and maybe the better news outlets that are available. That would be very interesting news, And we really need to get a handle on who's who. Okay, thank you very much.
If you'd like to make a comment on something you heard on KGNU, you can leave a message at our listener comment line at 303-447-9911. We play the messages back on Tuesday mornings at 8:25. And that's all the time we have for today's Morning Magazine. Thanks to Stacey Johnson, Steve Miller, Alexis Kenyon, Jamie Sudler, Franny Halperin, Joe Ritchie, and Justin Higginbottom. I've been your host, Shannon Young. Stay tuned for How on Earth. That's coming up just after these news headlines from the BBC.
Today's programming is brought to you by the Lichter Family Foundation in honor of George Lichter for a life well lived.
Julie Kendler. Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, the leader of the Belarus opposition, says the 18-year jail sentence imposed on her husband is revenge by President Lukashenko, but she said the opposition won't be cowed. Sergei Tikhanovsky was arrested in the run-up to last year's presidential poll. His wife stood in his place. Western countries say she won the vote.